Arlene Dickinson. Thanks for joining me on my podcast.
I have been a longtime partner of TELUS because I value the support they provide to both local businesses and entrepreneurs. Recently, TELUS launched Stand With Owners. It's an initiative that's targeted to support Canadian small businesses during COVID-19 because now more than ever, we could all use a bit of help. And that's why TELUS and I have partnered to provide all of my listeners with an exclusive limited time offer. Right now, if you bring your business to TELUS, you can receive 20% off a mobility plan for business, and you also get the first 3 months free. That's right, free. Visit telus.com/reinvention to redeem this offer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Reinvention. Today, I'm talking with KD Lang. I'm sure you know KD, Grammy and Juno award-winning singer and songwriter and a beloved Canadian icon and national treasure. But beyond that, you'll find that KD has such a unique mind and soul. She is so grounded for someone so famous. Take a listen.
Thanks for doing this, KD. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You and I have met in person yet at a time when you didn't even know you met me.
Really?
Yes. So I was trying to decide if I've got the worst memory when it comes to places, you know, like and dates. Okay. But I stood beside you and I believe it was at the Jasper Park Lodge. Does that sound familiar to you? Were you at the Jasper Park Lodge doing an event? Like I'm going to say a dozen years ago. Okay. Quite a while ago.
Is that in Jasper?
Yeah.
It might have been 30 or 35 years ago. But no, I haven't been to Jasper since.
Well, maybe it wasn't Jasper then because my mind is bad, but I was speaking there and I wanted, so it was either Banff or Jasper or one of those places. People from Banff and Jasper are going to get mad that I'm putting everybody together. But we were at the check-in.
It's just okay. Mountains.
It was a mountainy place. I was checking in and you were standing right beside me and I did not get starstruck. I'm just not that person. And I looked at you and I thought, I don't even know, like, I want to say hello to her. And like, I wasn't like, you wouldn't have even known who I was like at all because I was just starting out in television at the time. And not that you know who I am now, but then for sure.
I definitely do. And I'm a fan. I love that show. We watch it religiously.
But for sure then you wouldn't have known who I was. And I stood there and I was like, I think I could stand beside like Ryan Reynolds and not be as starstruck as I was standing beside you.
That's understandable.
That's true. That's true.
I'm kidding. Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you. I don't have a clue what you're talking about. It might have been the Banff Springs Hotel, maybe?
Oh, probably. You know what it might have been? Like, I'm pretty sure it was in Banff. I mean, you get on these circuits and you do all these events, and after a while, it's a hotel front that you don't really remember where you are.
Yeah.
But I know it was in the mountains for sure. And I know you were there to perform, and I was just going, and I think it had just been, it was you had done that performance during the Olympics, you know, Hallelujah, and I was like gobsmacked over. So it's gobsmacked.
It was a pretty big moment, that moment for sure.
Was it for you too? Tell me.
God. Yeah. I literally could write a novel just about that performance.
What do you go through? Like, are you like, so everything isn't the same for you? Like every performance isn't the same? Like there are moments when you're a performer?
No, to me, that was probably the biggest performance of my life, just because of a few variables that attributed to it. First of all, that it was the Canadian Olympics or the Olympics in Canada. The fact that they asked me to sing Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah was, you know, that's like a golden egg put in your lap.
Yeah.
And also my Buddhist teacher had passed away 2 months before. So I was very, very raw. And I talked to him a lot about the performance and before he passed away. And yeah, there was just a lot. And plus that the Georgian bobsledder luge had passed away. And
yeah,
it was heavy.
Yeah.
It was heavy. And It's funny because I spent a month sort of in isolation before the Olympics, walking and stretching, meditating, getting acupuncture, just getting myself sort of centered and calmed down because it was really nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
And, when I got to Vancouver, I did my rehearsals very, very meticulously. And I have to say that it was one of the only performances, sorry, I'm sort of spacing out, that's quarantine mind, but one of the few performances in my life where I was present in about six different realms simultaneously.
Yeah.
And completely present in all of them, which was fascinating. Anyway, it was a big, big moment in my life.
Was one of those realms there? Like when
yes.
You said it was, eh? So yeah. You could be really present in that moment and take that all in, because when I was watching you on the television, I said, I'll never forget it. I was watching thinking, this is just, it's just such a, like you say, I thought about the honor it must be to be performing, but your strength of your voice and the strength of the performance was like unlike anything I'd ever seen. I have to, like, so being in six realms makes, hey, six realms. Of course you were in six realms.
Hey, six realms. Yeah, because, enlightenment allows you to do that sort of thing.
I think I'd need a Buddhist teacher. If I could be in even more than one realm, I would be
Well, I obviously I don't have the capacity to actually be in six realms, but it felt like it, and I felt like I was aware of a lot of different realms, and I had to be hyper aware of where I was physically, because I was on a thing that was 80 feet high and I wasn't strapped in, and I was singing live and I didn't have in-ear monitors, so I had to be fully present of the physical space.
But you talk about like taking a month off to get ready for that moment. And I don't think, I mean, I certainly, because I'm not a performer, and you'll be happy to know I'm not going to sing on today's chat with you. No. She's giving me a thumbs down right now. But I often wonder how much preparation goes in mentally to just having the, because there's got to be an adrenaline side to performing live, and then also a fear side. Like there's the adrenaline that you're excited about it and, jazzed up for it. And there's got to be this overarching kind of terror that must go through your veins, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I studied Tai Chi when I was a youngster, and I really think of adrenaline and even like lack of sleep and nervousness as the type of energy that's coming towards you, and tried to always absorb it and redirect it. I always took the Tai Chi sort of theory behind performing. But I think the biggest component is getting your spirit, well, for me, is getting my spiritual component centered and understanding the profundity of the moment, and to be, like I said, present in every aspect of myself.
Yeah.
I don't have a month for every performance that I do, but I try to stay in that vein. I think maybe that's why I'm kind of feeling semi-retired, because it takes a lot of preparation to stay in that zone, in that performance zone for me.
I mean, we're not far apart in age, and I think it's a little bit of, it's the preparation, but I think you kind of, I don't know about you, but for me, I've kind of calmed down. Like I don't have the same highs and lows that I used to have around everything being like, if something didn't happen exactly the way I needed it to happen, like the world was ending or, right?
Yeah.
That's all leveled out for me. Has it for you? Like things are evener.
Yes, things are more even for sure. And I think also, like, you get yourself so caught up in, for me, I used to get myself so caught up in the compartmentalization of preparedness. Like I had to have my shower exactly an hour before I went on stage. I had to eat at 5 o'clock. I had to, all these things, I had to put my clothes on in a certain way. And I found them just to be a trap.
Yeah. Yeah.
All these like little, I mean, they help you because it's a kind of discipline, but at a certain point they imprison you.
Yeah.
And then one day, the bus broke down or something, and and a lot of things didn't happen. And the performance just kind of went on without any of the instruments or what, we just poured into it. And it was so liberating. And since then, I've been a little looser. I still have like general constructs of getting ready, but yeah, I'm a lot looser.
A lot of high performance people, it's on the, you know, there's an OCD to that, right? There's this, you've got to do it this way in order to have things be successful. And then, like you say, you realize when things don't go exactly that way, that you can still have it be very successful, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a lot of athletes do that. Like you see them go through, you know, whether it's, you know, a silent prayer they do, or they tie their shoelaces a certain way, or there's things that they do because it's a good luck in their head, but it's also preparedness. So you're mentally getting ready.
Yeah, absolutely.
You grew up, I just did a little bit of research on you. So you grew up, first of all, I didn't know you were Catherine Dawn Lang. I didn't know the KD stood for Catherine Dawn.
Catherine Dawn.
I only ever see you, hear you, or think about you as KD.
Good. Catherine. The only one that sort of gets away calling me Kathy is my mom, and I give her shit for it all the time.
Yeah, don't call me Kathy, but that's your name. No, it's not.
I don't look like a Kathy. Tell me, do I look like a Kathy?
No, you don't look like
Thank you. Kathy. Thank you.
You don't act like, I mean, not that I know what a Kathy looks like, but it's not you.
No, Kathy's definitely not me.
Yeah, you're definitely Katie.
Yeah.
So you were born in Edmonton?
Yes, I was.
So I came from South Africa, and you know where we moved to Edmonton when I was just a kid. So I was very early age in Edmonton. I lived in Hardesty Heights. Where were you? Whereabouts were you? Do you know?
Well, I never lived in Edmonton. I was just born in Edmonton, and then my family moved to Millet because my grandmother owned the drugstore there. But then my father, when I was 6 months old, bought the drugstore in Consort, Alberta.
How big's Consort?
650 people.
650 people. And you were there for how long?
My whole upbringing till I was 17, I think, when I finished high school.
So what is it like to be, I mean, there's so many questions I have to ask you. So you're in Consort, 650 people, 651 people, and you're growing up there. And describe life for me. Like, what was that like? Were you on a farm? Were you in the town?
I lived in town. My mother was a teacher. My father was a pharmacist and owned the drugstore. You know, I knew everybody in the town. Everybody knew me. I think I always talk about how small towns actually breed eccentricities, because in cities we gravitate towards like-minded people.
Yeah.
And in the country, everyone is your family. So all the eccentricities of one just becomes normal.
Right.
Because you know them intimately. And in the city, you kind of shun away from people who are different than you because you have the option.
I never thought of that, but you're exactly right. Like, and it's because I was in a small town for a while too. And there is an equality in a small town, because you know where they live, you know where their homes are, you know their friends, you know everything about them, right?
Yeah. And you know, Bill Holmes used to drive his tractor, he was a teacher, and he used to drive his tractor to school, and it was just what Bill Holmes did, you know. But if you lived in a city and you saw the math teacher driving to school every day on the tractor, you'd be like, you know, you'd roll your eyes.
Yeah, that's true. You'd probably be calling somebody with a little light on their top of their car going, what the heck's going on?
Yeah, exactly.
So, but you're in Consort. You have two sisters and a brother. Is that right?
That's right.
So you've got sisters and a brother. You're growing up in a small town. When did you start singing? How old were you?
Well, I am the youngest of all of the children, and we all studied classical piano.
Okay.
And we studied with a nun in Castor, Alberta, which was 60 miles away. And I'm the youngest the oldest is 11 years older than me. So it was quite a spread. By the time I got to piano lessons, I actually have zero capacity for academics. Everything I own is instinctual.
Okay.
So she really had no patience for me trying to learn the piano. And she said, you should try singing. So at the age of 5, I started to compete in the, you know, the Kiwanis festivals and search for talent and so forth.
And then did you just like it? Like, you're 5 years old, you're going, you're starting to compete. Like, when did they say she's got real talent? Like,
honestly, and I know this for sake of sounding immodest, the truth is that I've always inherently known that I was a singer. I never tried to apply myself in school. I really just knew that this was my path. I think it's very fortunate that I know it's a gift, and it made life very easy. And I just knew that I was going to be a singer. I mean, my mother tried to talk me into being a phys ed teacher for obvious reasons.
Really? Yeah. You'll never make a living being a singer.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you'd be better off being a phys ed teacher, but I always knew. Somehow I knew innately.
And so it's actually really awesome that you met a teacher in your life who actually said, hey, let's not focus on the piano, let's focus on the voice. Mm-hmm. And that's your instrument. And that's, you know, because maybe that's at 5 years old, somebody who was actually able to help you discover that that's what you always wanted to be. I mean, it sounds like you would have been a singer regardless, but it's helpful that somebody at an early age recognized it.
Yeah, it was very, very fortunate.
Are you still in touch with that teacher? She's still alive?
Oh, she passed away years ago. Yeah. She was an elderly woman when we were studying with her, I think.
And so you're in concert, you're doing all this, you're singing, you're going to school, not well, because you don't really want to go to school very well.
Well, I was a big athlete though. So school was important. And I had a crush on my English teacher. So I suddenly was able to function in English, but I told her that I had a crush on her a million times too, but yeah, so I was a big athlete. So really between, there weren't a lot of musicians in concert. I had a couple friends that were musicians. So it was really about volleyball and basketball and all the things that school afforded me.
And are you still active in sports? Are you still like, do you do anything that way now anymore?
No, I swim and I walk, but all my real sports were team sports. And after you quit school, you're kind of hooped. And then I worked so hard and then became famous. And so team sports weren't really an option for me.
No, that's true. The team sports, yours, it's a band is a team sport, I guess. That's
it. Yeah, exactly. Surviving the road is a team sport.
Get on that bus. No, I don't want to get on that bus. Yeah. So you graduated, you went to Red Deer College, and then I believe you formed your first band, which was a Patsy Cline kind of, a Patsy Cline tribute band called the Reclines.
Yeah, well, yeah, Katie Lang, the Reclines. And it wasn't a tribute band per se, but it was acknowledging her significant influence on my choices.
So you decided that you liked country.
Well, I got attracted to country. Now, let me say this tenderly. I really don't like country music. It's not the music. I don't like the mindset and the politics of country music. So I've always felt like an outsider. It's just that back then I felt like there was a lot of fodder for creating a sort of a modern take on something so traditional. So I was coming at it from kind of a different point of view.
So when you say there's politics, is that just simply because the genre is very traditional, or what is it about the politics of it?
Well, I think it's a combination of the tradition of it, the basic demographic of who listens to it, the politics of the business of country music, and also the advertisers of country music radio. So there's a lot of components there that I personally, from a mundane political and practical mindset, it's not the people individually I don't like, because I try to like everybody as a Buddhist, but the perpetuation of a certain mindset I feel uncomfortable with.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, and you've never had a problem speaking out or
no, never. That's never, no.
That's never been a challenge, really.
No, thanks for stating the obvious, Arlene. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. But it's true. Like you are, I mean, maybe it's because a little bit because of your small town upbringing that, you know, every voice had a right to be heard. Right. And I don't think you probably felt like you couldn't say what you wanted to say when you were growing up.
That's true. And also my parents, I think, really, really enabled my confidence, not only mine, but my siblings as well, because I grew up in a family where 3 out of 4 kids were gay. So it was definitely a different model for the prairies than usual.
And were your parents, so when you came out, were your parents, if 3 of the 4 of you were gay or are gay, is there any, was there an acceptance that you had that other people who are gay don't have when they're younger? Like, were you, did that help you to be more vocal or?
Well, the acceptance I had was through my siblings, and because they were older, so I had like a path laid out for me.
Right.
But my father had left the family by then, and so it was just my mom. And, you know, as parents do, my mom was just so sick with worry that I wouldn't be accepted or happy in society.
Yeah.
And was not happy about me coming out at that time.
Yeah.
But 17.
At 17. So you would have grown up, you're a single, so your mom, a single mom raising 4 kids in a small town, prairie town. I assume that you had probably no money. So there was a lot of sacrifice going on from your mom too, right?
Well, no, it wasn't quite all my siblings had gone by that time. I was, like I said, the youngest by quite a bit. So it was just mom and I. My dad, when he left my mom the drugstore. So financially, we were middle class, and she worked as a teacher. So, you know, we were middle class, and my mom and I just became pretty close because it was just her and I for a few years.
Yeah. And is your mom still alive?
She is. I'm in Edmonton right now. I've been having my through the window visits at her nursing home, but it's pretty weird.
It is weird. My mom is also in a seniors residence, and they don't even want us coming out to the windows. You know?
Really? Like, why? Yeah. What do they say?
I don't know. They're saying that they want, I think it's because they're worried about maybe the ability to stay distant. Maybe some people have broken down the barriers of what they were supposed to be doing, but it's really hard. They're starting to let people back in there now, but now I've got a little bit of fear of I could be asymptomatic and I don't want to take anything into the, you know, it's just so bizarre.
Well, I mean, the thing we have to keep in mind is nothing's changed. Not right. One thing has changed.
Right.
Except our awareness. But then you have, I'm all for being extra careful. It's funny because as someone who's bucked the rules my entire life, I'm certainly on the side of following the procedures right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you too. Well, you have bucked the rules. So you're growing up in that town. I'm trying to just get the picture here. And then you became like in Alberta. I remember this like yesterday as well. You became an animal rights activist and you became vegan, right? And to do that in Alberta of all places would have been incredible. Like talking about having the courage of your convictions and standing up. You did that at a time when nobody was really standing up doing that. Like what created that voice that you had in that area? Because I find that I remember reading that thinking, I wish I had a quarter of her courage to do that. Because I think that took a lot of courage.
I think it was because I saw it firsthand, you know,
yeah.
I was out there in the farms with my friends and I saw the inevitability of being a farm animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was shocking to me. And, even though I have also mellowed my strict viewpoint on the subject of vegetarianism, because I think through my Buddhist studies and also through life, I realized that, you know, there are people like, for example, the Tibetans, the only thing that grows there is barley and yaks. So you eat yaks and barley. So,
yeah.
I mean, I get it. But I think I just always had this vision that we don't have to, with the capacity that we have now for moving things around and for growing things indoors, we don't really necessarily need to rely on other beings to keep us sustained. So I guess I always felt that that was a possibility. And I do believe in reincarnation. So I feel like some of my insight came from a previous existence. So
I think that that's, I don't want to underplay what I believe you did, because you started a conversation long before the conversation became kind of, more cool, kind of hip conversation to have. It was, and I remember the backlash that you had against, like, from that.
I still have it. Oh yeah.
Really?
Alberta is not a completely comfortable place for me to live.
No, but you still live here.
Well, yeah, the circumstances brought me back here, but, and I'm happy about that. And I can tell you that I'm very happy to be in Canada in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Very happy to be living here. There's definitely, I drive the two every 5 days or 7 days or something. And I see a lot of indications that nothing has really shifted.
Yeah. And I think I was talking the other day to, do you follow Esther the Wonder Pig? Do you follow on social media Esther?
I don't think I follow Esther. I certainly follow some piglets though.
Oh, you need
similar.
Esther the Wonder Pig.
Okay.
Her dads are gay couple living out in Campbellville in Ontario. They've got a animal sanctuary, and they do these amazing things. And they had one of the guys had gone out to buy what he thought was a teacup pig, and was going to surprise his partner. Turns out it was an 800-pound pig.
The same thing happened to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But they changed their entire life around it. And I just think, whether you agree it or not, because, I'm not vegan and, but I have enormous respect for anyone who voices their own opinion and wants to do what they want to do. Like, doesn't matter. Like, I think, why do we judge people? Like, do what it is you need to do, to keep your life happy. And as long as you're not hurting or harming anything. And I think that the voice that you have brought and Jan Arden and Esther, her dads have brought to this, is that it's about the treatment as much as anything. It's about the inhumane treatment of some of the animals that I think causes a lot of the concern. But hey,
yeah, it's, well, listen, it is an extremely complex and never ending moral question. And that is part of being in this existence. So I think if we just even contemplate it once in a while, I think it's healthy. So
yeah.
I mean, you can look at the animals as being in service, and I try to look at that, and I do examine that. But there's all sorts of ways to look at it. Vegetarianism isn't perfect either, because when you flood a rice field, for example, you're killing countless insects.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also on your hands. That's also a part of your karma that you have to deal with. And so there's no way of existing on Earth without incurring negative karma by killing. So
yeah, the microbes exist in the ground that exists come up from the manure. You're exactly right. But I mean, I think that's all part of reinventing ourselves, right? We go through these moments of clarity, and I think when we hold on to beliefs so tightly that we can't expand ourselves to what else might be possible, what new information is out there, then we really lose out. And I find it really difficult when people get so stuck in their one perspective.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes. My mom and I call that the value cap. And I think that, there's a lot of people out there that just get lazy, and they inherit a certain, package of values, and then that's it. That's what they live by. And it's like, it's dangerous and lazy, I think.
It is. Well, you start to, I mean, that whole, you know, confirmation bias, you know, the whole idea that everything, once you believe something, everything reaffirms it, right? And you look for that affirmation and you start to think everything's a conspiracy against what you believe. And
yeah,
I mean, I grew up, I was raised as a Mormon. And so I've, you know, was raised in a very tight kind of idea of what good looked like and what good meant mm-hmm. to be. And all respect to any religion, I think it's the same thing, whether it's religious beliefs or whether it's dietary beliefs or whether it's, you know, beliefs of, about, you know, government or what politics, whatever it is. I mean, we can get so mired in it that we forget that, you know, to listen to voices like yeah. your anyone's, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So in your career, what was it like, just, you know, kind of going back to that, what was it like when you got your first record deal? Like you, did you, was that a big moment too?
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, my whole career was just, I had a lot of energy and a lot of confidence and a lot of momentum. And so just the speed of which I traveled at all times was just dizzying. But I took them on, but I, like, there are moments when I look back, like somebody will post a picture or somebody will mention something and I either don't remember it or barely remember it. And I'm like, really? I sang a duet with, you know, somebody. I don't even remember that. Like, and it's a huge deal, right? It's somebody big and like Paul McCartney at the Hollywood Bowl. And I'm like, oh my God, I was at the Hollywood Bowl with Paul McCartney.
You don't remember it?
Well, I do now. But there are things like that where you were moving so quickly and so much was happening that you don't remember it. But I can't remember what the question was or what your statement was.
Why you're just talking about when you got your first record deal and what that was like to get a contract, you know?
Oh yeah. Well, it was thrilling. Everything was thrilling. It was all thrilling.
But you do make an interesting point about how, and I don't know about you, are you a person that collects things on the road? Doesn't sound like you do. Though I don't either. And I wish now that I had a little bit of mementos because there are so many memories and it's hard to remember them all, right? And
yeah, but I also like being surprised
yeah.
when someone jolts you into remembering something. Like, I like to travel light. I pack light. I don't collect things. I'm not sentimental. And so when somebody brings something and jars my memory, I'm like, oh, that's super cool. I appreciate it, but I don't like to collect stuff.
No, but that's probably what makes you so unique is that you're truly living your life fully through your own eyes. Your experiences are better maybe because you meet these people, but they don't define your experience. I mean, it's not because you met them that makes the experience great. It was the entire experience that makes it great. If that makes sense to me, like to you, because it makes sense to me, obviously.
It's sort of making sense to me. I want it to make sense to me because you're saying it with such conviction that I want it to make sense to me.
You want to believe it. All right. Why don't you wear, you never perform wearing, you never wear shoes. Is that right?
Well, after the Meat Stinks thing, I was still wearing leather and somebody, you know, very sharply pointed out, well, you still wear leather. So .. And I went, oh, you're absolutely right. So I stopped wearing leather. And then it was just impossible back then. They're talking 1990.
Yeah.
It was impossible to find nice non-leather shoes. And so I just went, oh, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to just go bare feet. And then bare feet became something irreplaceable because of the way it grounded me and yeah. I could move my body more subtly because I became less kinetic on stage and more focused on the voice, and everything needed to be more subtle, and being barefoot was really a big part of that.
I remember I gave a speech once to I was in a room full of women for a women's award show. There was probably about 700 or 800 women in the room. And, you know, of course, I don't know, like for me, we were talking about this earlier before we started the conversation about how, you know, a little bit of vanity. If I'm in front of a group of women, the first thing I know I'm getting that I'm being judged. Like I'm thinking about my hair, my clothes, like stuff that I usually am not as fussed by, but I'm super aware of it when in a room full of women. And so I had on this long caftan and I thought I looked okay. You know, I looked as good as I was going to look. And I had on high heels and I started the speech that I was giving to this group of women. And about 5 minutes into it, I thought, you know what? My feet are killing me. All I'm thinking about is how I look right now. So I took my shoes off and like you could hear the gasps in the crowd. Like, oh, how could she do that? You know? And I just, exactly what you just described is I felt grounded. Like I felt completely like I could just be myself. It was a completely different view from that stage, having my feet touch the floor. And yeah. It's a funny thing, right?
Yeah. Well, it's all armor, you know, when you start dissembling it, it's liberating.
It is. But again, do you think that's an age thing? Have you always felt that way? Like, because were you not more concerned about how you appeared on stage when you were younger than you are today?
No, because I was so different already that anything, I just realized that anything even more different was to an asset.
Yeah.
Like I never fit in. So.
But you belong to everybody, Katie. Like you don't fit in, but you belong to us all. Like, does that feel weird to you? Like when I say that, I mean, we don't own you, of course, but I mean, your voice permeates our psyches in a way, like it's part of the story of my life, you know, like all the songs.
Yeah. No, that doesn't sound weird to me at all, because in my truest, most primordial nature, we are inseparable. And I am just a result of all who listen. So no, that doesn't sound weird. It's all the external stuff that's weird.
Yeah. But I do think like I certainly have become far less obsessed with, you know, kind of, I was always really hard on myself around weight, around, you know, looks, around wrinkles, around everything. I mean, when I didn't get on television until I was in my 40s. Yeah. And so I think I was already past that young. I don't know what would have happened if I'd found fame when I was young. I think it would have ruined me, because I think it would have just been a constant oppression around not feeling good enough. I like that self-dialogue around, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not thin enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not all these things. You centered yourself around your talent. Do you ever have anything that creates self-doubt, though, beyond like your voice? You're clear on who you are, but do you have self-doubt anywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of self-doubt. I don't feel like I've ever accessed my absolute source of what I want to say.
Yeah.
Like I feel like I'm like a diet version of what I'm feeling and what I want to access as an artist. Like I feel like I can't quite tap into the depths of where I want to go or who I want to be. And maybe it's too late. Maybe I won't in this lifetime, and that's okay too. But that doesn't diminish the stuff that I've accomplished. It just means that there's more. I think Lily Tomlin was the person that first brought me to the saying, the divine dissatisfaction of being an artist. Like there's always a deeper well to tap into.
I think that's true for entrepreneurs as well. You never feel like you're doing enough. Like there's always more to do. Maybe it's a different way of saying, what you're saying is I think more an expression of yourself, but I think entrepreneurs are expressing themselves through business. Like we all find different ways to express ourselves. And I totally relate to what you just said, that it's like there's always more you could do. Like did I really do, was I holding myself back, why didn't I let myself say what I really felt, you know? Like
speaking of that, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So through this pandemic and through the Trump administration, it's to me become even more blatantly obvious that corporate structure and corporate focus is misguided. And it's that corruption is so, so deep that how does one become, because I like business. I find it fascinating. I find, you know, invention and marketing. I'm infinitely interested in that. But how do we shift this?
The divide, you mean? Are you talking about the divide between is it the difference between the people who, I think I understand what you're asking, which is to me what's going on with business and this and corporations in particular, like large corporations, and they're very different than I think small business and the mentality of small business, but large corporations, it is a beast that needs to be fed, and it becomes, and the people do get lost, I believe in that. And I think this has shifted the capitalism is needing to be reconstructed, but it doesn't need to become socialism. And I think this is the battle that's out there, which is capitalism is bad. And I actually don't think capitalism is bad. I think capitalism without a heart is very bad. I think
But how do you reinstall any sense of altruism? Right. Because somehow society has trained us to believe that actually being fair and actually having a conscious about the environment and all that is naive or kind of, you know, hippy dippy or something. Like, I just don't know how we infuse any sort of altruism in corporations.
I think what's happening, there's a movement afoot, and it started about, I'd say about 10 years ago, and it's starting to gather real steam, which is, you know, there's a thing where people who are starting businesses today, particularly the younger generation, have social cause embedded in what they do. I mean, they all give back. They all believe in kind of giving back to society in some matter, whether it's companies like Tom's Shoes that gives back, you know, in the selling of their product and gives back to third world countries and helps make sure shoes are on the feet of everybody in the world. Or whether it's smaller companies that, you know, like a company that I've invested in, there's lots I've invested in actually, where they give money and some profits right off the top to organizations and groups that are in need in their communities. So I think it is shifting significantly. I don't believe anyone starting a business today is going to be successful unless they are grounded in the notion of giving back. And that they can't win at the expense of society's loss and people's loss. So, I think, you know, the thing about the pandemic, to your question, the thing that worries me is that through this pandemic, what will happen is that large corporations will be the survivors because they have the depth and the money and they're capitalized. They have the market. They can, you know, be big. And they can withstand a lot of these strains. Not all of them. There's some that are struggling hugely, but there's many of them that are going to survive and do very well through this. And that small businesses, the people that have this new view on giving back to people, planet, profit being all equal, as opposed to profit is everything, they're the ones that are going to be maybe potentially pushed aside because they won't have the ability to withstand what this pandemic is doing to them. So it's complex.
It's complex. Yeah.
Are you finding yourself consuming less now that you're home? Like, are you self-isolated other than you're seeing your mom?
Yes, absolutely. I've kind of been on that track for a while.
Yeah.
Consuming less and moving around less. And so I felt like I've been in training for this for a few years.
So you don't mind isolation? Well, you're with your partner, right? You don't mind isolation, though.
I'm very lucky. I live in a beautiful house with two other people. So yes, that's a blessing. But no, I don't mind isolation. I think it's such a opportunity, really, for us to quiet our minds a little bit and get to know ourselves a little more.
I agree. I'm a bit of a, I've said this often, but I am I'm definitely an introvert. And it's funny, people who look at probably yourself or me or anyone who's on stage. I mean, I'm not comparing myself to you by any stretch, but you know, in the public eye, when you're in the public eye, people think you're an extrovert, but that's not necessarily true at all. You know, it's probably the opposite.
Yeah.
Anything you want to say to people who are going through the pandemic right now? Yeah, I know I've taken a lot of your time, but anything that you want to share with people around thoughts around how they can manage through this a little bit differently as they're thinking about themselves?
I really find that nature is unbelievably rich and affordable right now. That it's, and by affordable, I mean affording us a lot of insight right now. Like the birds are not bothered by this, and the sky has been bluer, and I don't know. I just find nature extremely comforting and enriching right now. And if you have the opportunity, even if you're living in a small apartment, and just to open the window and just to watch the smaller things that are happening, but from an expanded point of view, that we are just such a small part of what's happening on this planet. And this pandemic, as my 97-year-old mother said yesterday, it's a natural course. And we're hoping that it's a natural course. It could be biological warfare, but that's a whole different thing. If it is a natural, it doesn't matter if it is man-made or natural. The fact is, it's a result of our collective consciousness. So we have to deal with what's happening. And it's forcing us to slow down and to be more mindful and just be kind to yourself and take solace in nature. That's my advice.
I think that's excellent advice. And I would echo that. I find going outside and being in nature the most calming thing I can possibly do. And you're right, the sky is bluer and the birds are happier and the animals are more free. And the, you know, that all feels like, it feels like nature out there is kind of rebalancing itself and reclaiming itself in some way. And maybe we have to pay that price right now in order for that to happen. And that is what it is. So
yeah. Yeah, but we're just a small part of it, you know. We got to remember that we are not the bosses of this world, contrary to a lot of, you know, Christian theological ideas. But, and maybe I'm wrong, but I just feel like we're just a small part.
You need to write a song about that.
Oh yeah, I need to write a song about a lot of things.
Well, I'll look forward to hearing it. And I want you to, you won't remember that we talked because you're not going to remember. You're going to say, if you forgot Paul McCartney, yeah. You're going to forget me.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, like everybody thinks this is such a great time to be creative. And I hope by God that a lot of people are being creative, but it just feels so like, I just feel I want to be completely available. Like when I'm creating, I'm sort of removing myself. Yeah. And I can't remove myself any more than I am. So
no, that's well. I'm very grateful you made yourself available to me and to have this conversation. I could talk a lot.
I've been waiting to be friends with you for quite a while since I watched Dragon's Den for the first time. So well, I love how you get up in Kevin's business.
Well, we'll be friends forever now. That's a given.
I hope so.
We support each other on Twitter a lot, and I'm very appreciative of that. So
yeah, that's a good thing. We can do a lot of good work on the socials.
That's true. Well, Katie, thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it. It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, and then next time that you're standing beside me, like, give me an elbow.
Well, I'm definitely going to talk to you now. I'm not going to be afraid of you whatsoever. Now I'm going to say, hey, it's me. What do you mean you don't remember me?
I'll remember you, believe me.
All right. Well, thanks.
Okay.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Be well.
Take care. Yeah. Bye.
All right. Tell me that you didn't hear it in her voice. I mean, it's not just in her singing voice. It's the way she talks. You can hear it. That deep, deep sense of self, of groundedness. I mean, how she approaches her music and her life with such thoughtfulness and such sincerity. It's no wonder her music is soulful. She's so soulful. I love what she called the value cap, that package of values that you sometimes have just inherited. I love that because anyone who wants to reinvent themselves has to first see themselves as they really are,
And that means taking a hard, hard look at all the values you have just accepted up to now. Whether it's your religion, prejudice, what you eat. Anything that you just accept without examining, well, that's dangerous. And you can hear it in Katie's music and in her activism, how freeing it is to be mindful and soulful and to be truly yourself. Anyways, it was an amazing conversation. I'm so grateful to KD for sharing her time and her thoughts with me. Now I'm going to go back and watch the video of her performing at the Olympics again, because now we know exactly what was going through her mind as she prepared and delivered that amazing rendition of Hallelujah. Stay safe and stay human.
This podcast is made possible by the great folks at Venture Communications. Thanks to our engineers, writers, producers, and all the folks who work really hard to bring you these great stories of reinventions each and every week.